Historically, people with an intellectual disability have been treated only as a subject of research. But a shift over the last two decades has led to a rise in inclusive research. This is where people are not only able to have their own unique voices heard in scientific study, but are also able to be involved as co-researchers. Welcome back to the Medical Republic. I'm Francine Crimmins. This episode, I'll be joined by Professor Eva Stanadova, who is a lead researcher at the Disability Innovation Institute at the University of New South Wales. While her main work is primarily in empowering people with disability to negotiate life transitions, and this is mainly through their educational experience, it also crosses over into how people with intellectual disability experience inclusivity in their general life. And this often occurs with their engagement through the health system. Professor Eva Stanadova, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Francine.
And can you explain your research project to us a little bit more?
My research is particularly focused on issues relevant to people with intellectual disability and autism. So I've explored topics such as parenting of people with intellectual disabilities, transitions that they experience across their lifespan, being transition from home to school, from primary to secondary school, from secondary school to post-school life, but also, for example, transition to retirement or to older age. I've been also exploring other topics such as sexuality education, so their inclusion, social inclusion, and how, for example, mobile technology can assist to their increased inclusion. My research is underpinned by inclusive research, which is an approach in which people with intellectual disability are researchers, are co-researchers, not just participants in studies.
And to start with, you're a world leader in inclusive research. Would you start by explaining what inclusive research means in case people haven't heard of this concept before?
Inclusive research is about people with disabilities and specifically people with intellectual disabilities being involved in the research not only as participants, but actually as researchers.
And what makes inclusive research different in the process of actually doing the research compared to other research models?
It is really based in the movement of nothing about us without us, meaning that issues relevant to people with intellectual disabilities should not be explored by people who do not have that lived experience. In this process, people with intellectual disability co-design the research. They really are discussing with the academic researchers what is the topic of the research and how relevant it is to their lives, but also then co-design the whole methodological approach and conduct the study with them. I can tell you example of such a research from my own experience. I've been engaged in inclusive research for quite many years now. One of the studies, for example, that I have been engaged lately focused on sexuality education for students with intellectual disabilities. I've been conducting this study together with Julie Loblinsk, who is my dear colleague and friend. She is a self-advocate. Herself has intellectual disability and is mother of three children and has worked all her life in supporting other people with intellectual disabilities. We have conducted some research studies before, and one of them was focused on parents with intellectual disabilities. And as we kept on talking to these parents, what kept on coming up more and more was that the parents talked about their lack of sexuality education when they were in school. Very often they were, this is for mothers, they were surprised that they were pregnant, didn't realize it could happen, and so on. And we were really discussing then whether sexuality education has changed over the years, because at the time of Julie's schooling years, she had no sexuality education, as it was perceived wrongly, of course, that as somebody with intellectual disability, she wouldn't need it. So we designed a study, and we talked to young girls, high school students in New South Wales, and their teachers and parents about their sexuality education at school. And it was really interesting what we found out. Some things were encouraging, some less encouraging. We definitely could hear about topics that are still being excluded for this population. For example, there is a lot of focus on, you know, using contraception or sexually transmitted diseases, but really not on planning for pregnancy. Yet we know that people with intellectual disabilities do become parents. Another big topic that was missing was focus on other identities than heterosexuality. And so students talked about how, for example, homosexuality is not talked about in school. One of the students who herself identified as being asexual and gender fluid talked about how difficult it was for her to really understand to herself, because these things are just taboo at school as topics in this area. Another quite concerning finding was that, and it wasn't in all schools, of course, but some teachers did not focus or include in sexuality education topics such as domestic violence. And yet we know that people with intellectual disability are at least four times more likely to become victims of domestic violence in their lives. And also they are very, very much more likely to become victims of sexuality abuse. So there were some findings that indicated that the sexuality education can improve for this population for sure.
And you recently received a grant from the New South Wales Department of Education to develop and implement some accessible methods so that, you know, students with intellectual disability or high support needs could have that bigger say in the pattern and the trajectory of their education. Would you mind talking a little bit about that project and what's next?
Oh, definitely. That's a beautiful and so exciting project. So I'm collaborating with the Department of Education in New South Wales with their Disability Strategy Implementation Team on a project where we are using accessible surveys and also arts-based methods to give voice to students with moderate to high support needs to have a voice about their education. And that came from a very well identified gap, which is that while students in New South Wales, students without disability have opportunity to have a say about their schooling experience by completing Tell Them From Me survey, the students with disability really do not have that opportunity. Not that they couldn't complete the survey theoretically, but the survey is not accessible for this population.
So as you've just mentioned, when working with children of different ages with an intellectual disability, they sometimes can't express themselves in the way that atypical people would. So do you mind explaining, I know it's very normal to your everyday work, but what does that experience actually look like? What is something like the photo voice method that you just mentioned or the body mapping method, and what does that tell you?
Oh, absolutely. I would just start with elaborating, because you are right, it's very usual to my daily experience, but not not everybody might know, intellectual disability is a very wide term, and covers very wide range of abilities. So some people would have just a mild intellectual disability where you would really not be probably even able to tell that they would have intellectual disability. They would maybe struggle with abstract thinking a bit, or would need more concrete explanations of things. These students need more accessible language, ideally easy read, which is combination of pictures and sentences with not too complicated terms, and these students can very easily function with some support in mainstream schools. But you can also have students who have much higher support needs, including those who would have limited or no verbal communication at all, and who would have much more extensive cognitive impairment. And so for these students, it's really difficult to engage in the typical way and really express their experiences and perspectives. So giving them alternative tools other than reading or speaking is quite essential. Example of a photo voice in this context would be that we ask students to use iPad, which usually, or tablet, which is usually accessible at schools where they are at, and they are supported by their teachers and asked to take pictures of things that they like about their school or that make them happy at school. And then when they take the photos of these things or people, they communicate about it with their teacher to explore it in more depth. Communicate in a way that they usually communicate. So it doesn't necessarily have to be verbal communication.
And quite often, it's a lot of the onus is on the kids saying what they want, and trying to go through these research projects to try and find that out, mm-hmm. and improve the way that their education experience and their transition between mm-hmm. different levels of education. But what might schools be able to do, in your experience, that actually makes it a more inclusive environment in the first place, where those thoughts or those ideas from the children are able to flow through without them having to try so hard to undergo a research project like this?
Oh, this is a brilliant question. I think that for me the biggest thing is the attitudes that are held by different stakeholders in the students' education. Very often people underestimate those with intellectual disability. Some teachers might have low expectations of these students. They might, because of lack of experience or maybe gaps in their education, there might they might have lower expectations about the post-school outcomes of these students. So, for example, I've met with mainstream school teachers who would think that their students with intellectual disabilities will end up after school working in, sheltered workshop or being at home with parents, and they never even assumed that they could be employed in open employment, that they could be in relationship, that they could become good parents. And of course, if you are approaching your students with so much underestimation and such a low expectations, you don't challenge them in their education. You might even underestimate what they are trying to tell you, or not take it seriously. And I think that's a huge issue. So for me, the biggest thing is really teachers and school principals and anybody in the school just being well informed about the kind of the whole lifespan picture for this population, that these students can achieve in their lives, and that they can have families, and that they can be employed, and they can do all the other things that everybody or many people without disability do and have, and that they do challenge them, not in an unrealistic expectations, but definitely that they have high expectations, and that they support these students in meeting these expectations.
And your projects, I know, also work towards the idea that these individuals should be growing up and engaging with policy in the world around them in the way that other individuals do, because they are very much impacted by those policies and they need to know how to engage in them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's really critical. And it, you know, it's... This we talked about at the beginning of this interview about inclusive research and about co-designing and co-producing research with people with intellectual disability, and that does keep on happening now more widely, and you know, hopefully will even increase across different areas, not just education, but what might be of interest to your targeted audience, which are general practitioners. It also is now being increasingly used in health research. There are research studies where people with intellectual disabilities are co-researchers and explore their experiences with general practitioners and how they are being treated, whether they are offered the same opportunities, let's say, as their patients who do not have intellectual disability, for example.
Yes, I was actually going to ask about that. I know that in medicine, there's often an issue here where sometimes people with intellectual disability aren't offered the same treatment that would be age appropriate to someone without an intellectual disability. So you might have someone who is hospitalized with an intellectual disability and they're not treated the same way that, say, an individual without an intellectual disability who's 30 years of age would be treated. They're sometimes treated like they're aged or are different to. Is this something that you come across quite regularly?
Oh, don't get me started. Unfortunately, absolutely yes. There is very often people with intellectual disability are treated as children while they are adults. I think that's one thing where we definitely can improve. Another very typical experience that people with intellectual disability complain about is that they, when they come to the medical practitioner, the doctor or nurse or whoever it is automatically talks to their parent, or if there are a student, if it's an adult, they will talk to anybody that accompanied them there. So they kind of like don't even approach straightforwardly the person with intellectual disability, which is of course offending. There are issues about approach, as you said rightly, age appropriate, or just directly engaging with the person. I think it's also just about being respectful. Another big issue that is identified in research, and we know about it, people with intellectual disability are often not offered the same treatment as would people without disability, so which can have a very severe impact on their health. And it can be treatment or examination. We know from research that people with intellectual disability are less often encouraged to have, for example, screening for cervical cancer, and with talking about women, of course, with and very often the assumption identified well in the research is that these women wouldn't need it because they don't live sexually, and that's of course not true. And that then leads into more incidences of cancer and unnecessary death of this population. So there are huge inequities that can be addressed in health.
And just to end with, what are your hopes to get out of these educational projects where you co-design with people with intellectual disability?
I just really want to encourage and somehow contribute that people with intellectual disability have a say about things that are important to them, that really matter in their lives, that they can impact things that that influence them, being policies or everyday experiences and encounters with other people. So I just would love to at least somehow contribute to their better lives, to better quality of life.
Thank you so much for joining me on the program and for sharing all your interesting research with me.
Thank you for having me, because this again gives an opportunity for people to hear about these issues. So I'm really happy that you invited me. Thank you.
If you want to listen to episodes you may have missed, or if you want to subscribe to this podcast, just search for The Medical Republic on your favorite podcast server. Or you can listen to all the episodes directly on our website. That's medicalrepublic.com.au. Catch you next time.